Chapter 26. All the while, during the ups and downs of Marilyn Monroe's career, Dorothy Kilgallen kept tabs on her friend. And before both women died, there was a definite bond between them regarding a rather bizarre subject. Little doubt exists Kilgallen had a real fascination, as Marilyn Monroe did, with the belief that UFOs, unidentified flying objects, were more fact than fiction. In fact, the two celebrities' obsession with UFOs may be connected to JFK and his assassination. Kilgallen's own writings substantiate her interest in the subject. In 1955, she visited London, and in the May 22, 1955 edition of the Los Angeles Examiner, the Cincinnati Inquirer, and other major newspapers distributed by the international news service that her father Jim had once worked for during World War II, this headline appeared: "Those little men on flying saucers? Real," says Kilgallen. The text read, "By Dorothy Kilgallen. Distributed by International News Service. London, May 22. British scientists and airmen, after examining the wreckage of a mysterious flying ship, are convinced that these strange aerial objects are not optical illusions or Soviet inventions, but actually are flying saucers which originate on another planet. The source of my information is a British official of cabinet rank who prefers to remain unidentified. We believe, on the basis of our inquiries thus far, that the saucers were staffed by small men, probably under 4 feet tall," my informant told me today. "It's frightening, but there is no denying the flying saucers come from another planet." This official quoted scientists as saying a flying ship of this type could not have been constructed on Earth. The British government, I learned, is withholding an official report on the flying saucer examination at this time, possibly because it does not wish to frighten the public. When my husband, Richard Colmer, and I arrived here for a brief vacation, I had no premonition that I would be catapulting myself into the controversy over whether flying saucers are real or imaginary. In the United States, all kinds of explanations have been advanced, but no responsible official of the U.S. Air Force has yet intimated the mysterious flying ships had actually vaulted from outer space. In addition, months before, Kilgallen had written another column. To begin the column, Kilgallen wrote that actor Peter Lawford's unexpected visit to New York will be the big movie colony story of the year and the society pages, too, since the girl accompanying Hollywood's most eligible bachelor is Pat Kennedy, daughter of the former ambassador to the Court of St. James, Joe Kennedy. The famous columnist concluded the column with, "Flying saucers are regarded as such vital importance that they will be the subject of a special hush-hush meeting of world military heads this summer." She did not elaborate further. Speculation runs rampant with these theories, but what may be substantiated is that an August 3, 1962 FBI primary source document exists, unclassified in 1984, featuring the contents of a wiretapped conversation between Kilgallen and her friend Howard Rothberg, the former owner of a New York-based antique store, who dealt with photographers of Marilyn Monroe and passed along information to Kilgallen one day before Monroe died. For purposes of clarity, it will be designated as the Rothberg Report, a heretofore mostly ignored connection between the two women that appears to be quite valid, especially when considered in context with the new evidence included in this book about the two women's deaths. Though the writing is somewhat fuzzy, the first paragraph below the words Marilyn Monroe in the subject line appears to read, "Wiretap of telephone conversation between reporter Dorothy Kilgallen and a close friend Howard Rothberg, A, from wiretap of telephone conversation of Marilyn Monroe and Attorney General Robert Kennedy, B, appraisal of content." While the remainder of this primary source document will be discussed further, Of special interest here is the following text. 1. Rothberg discussed the apparent of subject with Kilgallen and the breakup with the Kennedys. Rothberg told Kilgallen that Marilyn was attending Hollywood parties hosted by the inner circle among Hollywood's elite and was becoming the talk of the town again. Rothberg indicated in so many words that she had secrets to tell, no doubt arising from her trysts with the president and the attorney general. One such secret mentions the visit by the president at a secret air base for purposes of inspecting things from outer space. Kilgallen replied that she knew what might be the source of visit. In the mid-50s, Kilgallen learned of secret effort by the U.S. and U.K. governments to identify crashed spacecraft and dead bodies from a British government official. Kilgallen believed the story may have come from in the late 40s. Kilgallen said that if the story is true, it would terrible embarrassment to Jack Kennedy and his plans to have NASA put men on the moon. Connecting Rothberg, who was one of the invitees, as noted, to the weekly science club Kilgallen hosted at P.J. Clark's, to Kilgallen is also possible, it may be recalled, since he was the one she showed a thick grouping of papers hidden inside the Life magazine cover depicting Lee Harvey Oswald holding the Mannlicher Kirkcano rifle the authorities swore he used to assassinate John F. Kennedy. When Rothberg asked, "What's this?" Kilgallen calmly replied, "It's just part of the Warren Commission report." In yet another shocking memo, a 1962 CIA document alleges that during a taped phone call 2 days before Marilyn died, she told Kilgallen that JFK had told her of his visit to a secret airbase where he viewed things from outer space. This admission allegedly involved the 1947 Roswell, New Mexico crash of what government officials swore was an Army Air Force balloon. Later, it was alleged that, in fact, an alien spacecraft, with extraterrestrials aboard, had crash-landed in the area, and the government covered up the incident. While this information seems quite credible, disagreement reigns regarding whether, during a press briefing that was supposed to be off the record, JFK was asked what he thought about UFOs. Various accounts allege that he became very serious and replied, "I would like to tell the public about the UFO situation, but my hands are tied." Based on this account being accurate, theories have circulated that the president was assassinated by those who feared his disclosure of further information about the UFO phenomenon. In fact, he requested, according to a letter released by the CIA, more information on UFOs on November 12, 1963, within days of his assassination. The subject line read, "Classification Review of All UFO Intelligence Affecting National Security." If the president spoke the words, "I would like to tell the public about the UFO situation, but my hands are tied," then Marilyn's revealing her conversations with him about that subject put her in a dangerous position to be a threat to his presidency. Many of the electorate at the time scoffed at the possibility that the little green men Kilgallen described could have visited planet Earth. JFK thus would have been ridiculed for believing it was even possible that landings, such as the supposed crash at Roswell, actually happened. The president's credibility would have certainly suffered a serious blow. Another indication of Marilyn discussing matters of importance appears in a July 1962 FBI memorandum to Director FBI, obtained by this author through the Freedom of Information Act. The FBI female informant shadowing Marilyn revealed that the subject, Marilyn Monroe, had told her that she had lunch at the Peter Lawfords with President Kennedy just a few days earlier. She said she was very pleased, as she had asked the president a lot of socially significant questions concerning the morality of atomic testing and the future of the youth of America. She had already been asked by Lawford to appear at the president's birthday party. Confirming the luncheon was an attachment dated 7/26/62, just days before Marilyn died. Through the years, similarities between Kilgallen's death and Marilyn's have been debated, but never fully examined in context with the JFK assassination. Both supposedly died of barbiturate overdoses, Nembutal included. Both were found dead in a bedroom under mysterious circumstances. Both allegedly had information that could be lethal to those who feared exposure for their actions and/or abuse of power when they died, and so forth. Some likelihood exists that the manner by which Marilyn died triggers the belief that her murder could have been a dress rehearsal for how Kilgallen may have been killed. Another possible common denominator between the two remarkable women comes from Dorothy's butler's daughter, Brenda Desjardins, who told this author, "When Marilyn died, Dorothy said, 'She was a friend of mine and she didn't deserve this.' Dorothy tied it to the Kennedys." This said, toward the middle of August, Kilgallen had either received erroneous information from a good source or bad information from a bad source, since she wrote a column suggesting that Marilyn had attempted suicide the night before she died, which was completely untrue. Kilgallen also insinuated that Dr. Theodore Kerfey had interviewed Marilyn's housekeeper, Eunice Murray, which apparently never happened. Attempts to discover whether Kilgallen later corrected these errors have not been fruitful, but Desjardins' primary source evidence and Kilgallen's column entries shortly after Marilyn's death confirm Kilgallen's belief that the famous actress had not committed suicide or died accidentally. Just after Marilyn died, Jane Russell, the voluptuous screen siren best known for the Howard Hughes-produced film The Outlaw, who also co-starred with Marilyn in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and who may be seen in a photograph with Marilyn at columnist Walter Winchell's birthday party, provided an interesting perspective of Marilyn. Russell told author Edwin Hoyt, "She was always sweet and friendly with the stagehands and the crew on the set. She was striving to be a well-rounded individual, trying to educate herself. Marilyn seemed to me to be a thoughtful person, a searching person." Later, in a 2007 interview with the Daily Mail, Russell recalled that she had met Marilyn when her first husband, whom she had gone to high school with, introduced Marilyn as his wife. "She was a pretty girl," Russell said, "and later on I discovered that she was shy and sensitive." During filming of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, she said actor Tommy Noonan was asked what it was like to kiss Marilyn Monroe, and he excitedly said, "It was like being swallowed alive." When Marilyn heard that comment, Russell explained, "Marilyn ran crying to her dressing room." In the article, Russell was quoted as saying that Marilyn was certainly not a dumb blonde, and that right before she died, she was planning to marry Joe DiMaggio, her second husband, again, and she had a new movie contract, so I don't think she killed herself. Russell then nodded approval when the interviewer suggested John and Robert Kennedy may have been involved, adding, "Soon after Marilyn died, I met Bobby Kennedy, and he looked at me as if to say, 'I am your enemy.'" One indication of Marilyn being curious to learn about all sorts of different subjects emerges from a little-known visit she made during her time with Joe DiMaggio to the Roy Goldenberg Galleries in Los Angeles, where there was a book auction. The items on auction included a collection of annotated manuscripts by Max Reinhardt, the Austrian theatrical director and producer dubbed the man who invented modern theater direction, who first achieved acclaim when he produced William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream in 1905. Marilyn apparently had knowledge of Reinhardt's work through her acting coach Natasha Lites, and when the manuscript collection was set for auction, Marilyn began the bidding and finally won with a bid of $1,335, almost $12,000 in modern currency. Sadly, the auctioneers, who finally recognized her, notified the press, and they crucified Marilyn for conducting what they charged was a publicity stunt. According to Edwin Hoyt, Marilyn was insulted by the accusations to the point where she made arrangements to sell the manuscripts for the same price she paid to Reinhardt's son. According to Hoyt, Marilyn learned something from this experience. She learned that the press and the public did not believe that she had a brain. The press would never believe it, and so the public would not learn until she died that she was a bright girl as well as a beautiful and sensuous one. Hoyt's words describe in general Marilyn's feelings, but since she was so sensitive, the bet is that when she arrived home she may have sat down and cried. To be mocked for even attempting to display her intellectual side had wounded Marilyn's pride, and the temper that she seldom permitted to surface must have been in full force over the incident. As further evidence of the human side of Marilyn, so often ignored as Hoyt opined, he related a story that took place during the filming of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, released in 1953. The author wrote that Marilyn had recognized that her singing of Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend was to be her shining moment in the film. Despite everyone in the cast, including director Howard Hawks and even her acting coach Natasha Lites, believing the first take of her singing and dancing was superb, Marilyn was not satisfied. To the chagrin of those who had to put up with 10 more takes, Marilyn kept repeating her performance. Finally, she looked at the footage, declared that all of the others were right and she was wrong, and even, according to Hoyt, climbed up on the podium where musical director Lionel Newman was standing and apologized to the orchestra and the entire assemblage. Hoyt added, "The orchestra members, who had grown tense and moody during this torture, sat up and applauded her." Brenda Desjardins telling this author that Kilgallen believed the Kennedys were involved in Marilyn's death is consistent with Kilgallen's belief that the famous actress did not commit suicide, as is expressed in a column where she wrote, as will be explored further, "The real story of Marilyn's death hasn't been told, not by a long shot." Common sense dictates that Kilgallen, at the top of her career, with the best sources at her beck and call, with the power she possessed, had her ear to the ground regarding the most credible information available when her friend died. Using her skill as an investigative reporter, she was apparently privy not only to evidence proving that Marilyn did not die accidentally as a result of an overdose of barbiturates, but, more importantly, why she was murdered. Did Marilyn Monroe feel like she was invincible shortly before she died? Did she have to worry about enemies circling who could cause her harm? If so, were they the Kennedys? To investigate Marilyn's death, it's very likely Kilgallen would have begun by taking a careful look at how Marilyn became involved with the Kennedy family in the first place. The famous reporter would have then gone forward to learn what could have made Marilyn so dangerous that she had to be eliminated. Apparently, the first time Marilyn and JFK could have met was in 1957 at the April in Paris ball at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City. Each attended the festivities, but JFK escorted Jackie, and Marilyn held hands with celebrated playwright Arthur Miller, soon to be her husband. Sometime later, Peter Lawford's wife, JFK's sister Patricia, who had become a good friend of Marilyn's, invited her to a dinner party at the Lawfords' home in Santa Monica, California. JFK had been present at a luncheon earlier in the day, but it is not known whether Marilyn was a guest there as well. Regardless, the famous president and the equally famous actress were formally introduced during a party at singer Bing Crosby's Palm Springs home on March 24, 1962, less than 5 months before Marilyn mysteriously died. Apparently, there was more than just an introduction, with the twosome having a sexual encounter, though the Kennedy family denied it ever happened. Actress Susan Strasberg, a good friend of Marilyn's, and the daughter of renowned acting coach Lee Strasberg, who, as it may be recalled, believed Marilyn's death was not a suicide, said, "There was something unique and special about her," and confirmed the affair. Others dispute the account, creating confusion about exactly what had happened, a common occurrence regarding virtually all aspects of Marilyn's life from birth to death. Marilyn's hairdresser, Jimmy Morrissey, also confirmed the JFK-Marilyn romance and a similar one with Robert Kennedy. He stated, "I did her hair twice while she was going with the president and two times when she was going with the president's brother. When she was talking about the president, she called him that man." On April 11, 1962, just a few months before her death, Marilyn received a typed letter on White House stationery from Kenneth O'Donnell, special assistant to President Kennedy. It read, "Miss Monroe, many thanks for your acceptance of the invitation to appear at the president's birthday party in Madison Square Garden on May 19th. Your appearance will guarantee a tremendous success for the affair and fitting tribute to President Kennedy. To date, no one has discovered exactly whose idea it was to extend an invitation to Marilyn. Regardless, Marilyn agreed to sing Happy Birthday to JFK in New York City to an audience of 15,000, performing along with Ella Fitzgerald, Harry Belafonte, Jimmy Durante, and Peggy Lee. After Marilyn's sultry voice had livened the crowd, the president took the stage and said, 'I can now retire from politics after having had Happy Birthday sung to me in such a sweet, wholesome way.' He probably never knew that the song was almost stricken from the program, since her rehearsal was so steamy that Kennedy's gala music director, Richard Adler, wanted to drop it as being too risque. The famous photo of Marilyn sandwiched between Bobby and JFK, taken by White House photographer Cecil Stoughton in Kennedy friend Arthur Krim's penthouse after the event, while hiding the two Kennedys' full faces from view, portrays a very serious look on Marilyn's face. No account of exactly what was being said has ever surfaced, but it appears to be a serious conversation. Based on what happened, as will be explained, after these three iconic personalities met and their lives intersected, a definite recipe for disaster for each of them was on the horizon. Marilyn's dress is a story all by itself. In a Guardian article published in 2016, reporter David Thompson wrote, "That dress didn't just happen. It was the work of Jean-Louis. Born in France in 1907, he had come to the U.S. as a fashion designer and then got into the movies. He did work for the Duchess of Windsor, and he also created the black satin dress worn by Rita Hayworth in Gilda, 1946. Hayworth does a restrained striptease, drawing off her elbow-length gloves in the Put the Blame on Mame number, which was thought daring in its day. After the war, a pressure grew in movies. It was censorship-fighting desire, in which we were asked to imagine what a woman would look like without clothes. It was as if there was a cultural blooming that had to break out of its sheath. The dress, with all its inserted beads, it took 500 backstage stitches to assemble the dress directly onto Marilyn's famous form, was said to have cost $12,000 in 1962. In 1999, it was sold for $1.3 million, and then again in 2016 for $4.8 million. Throughout the night, actor Peter Lawford, aware of Monroe's reputation for being late, kept introducing her, only to look back at an empty stage and call for the next speaker to appear. Lawford became frustrated, but as the night of celebration wore on, Marilyn finally shimmied onto the stage. Not realizing Marilyn would be dead within a short time, Lawford eerily welcomed her as the late Marilyn Monroe. The actress then shed her ermine stole to reveal the famous gown, its tone and shimmering crystals giving the impression she was naked. Time magazine reported, "That figure was famous, and for one breathless moment, the 15,000 people in Madison Square Garden thought they were going to see all of it." Of all the comments made that day by journalists around the world, Dorothy Kilgallen stole the show, just as Marilyn had done. In her Voice of Broadway column, she wrote, "It seemed like Marilyn was making love to the president in front of 40 million Americans." Later, Marilyn told Life magazine, "The approval of the crowd was like an embrace." The photo of the three bigger-than-life personalities huddled together portended of danger looming in the future. This is especially true since, from Joseph Kennedy on down the line through JFK and RFK to Ted, the Kennedys were predators, each animalistic in their view of the female persuasion. And Marilyn was the perfect target for the brothers, according to a Las Vegas Sands hotel casino pit boss during the 1960s, one who experienced firsthand the workings of the underworld, the CIA, and the FBI during this period. A close friend of Frank Sinatra who worked at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas, this source, who demanded confidentiality for fear of repercussion, told this author in an April 2020 interview, "Marilyn reached out to the powerful, new big-time people for sure. She idolized anyone of notoriety, that is, for a while." So was this it, the last time Marilyn and JFK, the two bigger-than-life celebrities, spent time together, intimate or otherwise? Did the relationship cool after that, or did it heat up to explosive proportions, leading to questions about whether the Kennedys had a hand in Marilyn's death, as Kilgallen apparently suspected? A partial answer to this question requires stepping back in time to understand Marilyn's mindset during the months before she died. In 1961, she had starred in The Misfits, written by Arthur Miller and directed by John Huston. Co-stars were Clark Gable and Montgomery Clift. In the film, Marilyn plays a soon-to-be-divorced ex-stripper who meets a colorful cowboy, Gable, and his pal, a former World War II aviator, Eli Wallach, in Reno, Nevada. The two men fawn over the curvy blonde who is trying to figure out what to do with her life, leading her to accept an invitation to move into a half-finished home in the desert owned by Wallach's character. Displaying the wide range of acting skills she had learned through the years based on hard work, classes, and a never-give-up attitude, Marilyn navigates the much older Gable's love for her as well as the affections of a rodeo rider, Clift, and the three men's obsession with capturing wild horses. The sensitive, looking-for-love Marilyn steals the film with the men throwing compliments at her such as, "You just shine in my eyes," and "When you smile, it's like the sun coming up." By the end of the motion picture, Marilyn, displaying the emotions of a seasoned movie star, has won the hearts of everyone, leading to she and the Gable character heading for parts unknown. Marilyn's superb performance surely provided proof that she had realized a dream of hers. First husband Jim Dougherty had written in his book, it may be recalled, that when she entered films, Marilyn wanted to be an actress, someone who could play any part. Her multidimensional portrayal of Rosalyn in The Misfits was Marilyn at her best, the crowning jewel to an impressive body of work that will live on for centuries to come. After Marilyn died, director John Huston said of her work in The Misfits, "She was just splendid in the picture. It was an extraordinary quality she had. This kind of genius, something strange and unpredictable would come out of her when she acted." Further primary source evidence of Marilyn having mastered her trade comes from viewing footage of her final film, Something's Got to Give. Studio executives were upset with Marilyn's tardiness on set as well as her performance. But the footage proves that this performance, given in April 1962, 17 months after she starred in The Misfits and 4 months before she died, was first rate. Coupling these two performances with Marilyn's tribute to JFK indicates a woman in possession of her faculties. No slurring words, no temperament bordering on her being mentally ill. She had sung, in part, "Thanks, Mr. President, for all the things you've done, the battles that you've won, the way you deal with U.S. Steel and the problems by the ton. We thank you so much, without so much as a stumble." Marilyn was at her best, sharp, confident, and ready to perform in front of the bright lights, just as Dorothy Kilgallen was on the final What's My Line program she performed on shortly before her death. As Marilyn sang her heart out, the crowd at Madison Square Garden screamed in ecstasy, causing composer Richard Adler to exclaim of the 17-minute performance, "It was like a mass seduction." Nowhere to be seen was First Lady Jackie Kennedy, whom Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates said knew about the affair between Marilyn and her husband, as many others did, as noted in his autobiography, The Chief. 2 hours later, after Marilyn relaxed, she appeared in full capacity of her faculties at a party given by theater bigshot Arthur Krim. Within moments, JFK, by all credible accounts, asked Marilyn to step into the shadows where RFK stood, and the three of them spoke for more than 10 minutes. Then, after midnight, the Secret Service escorted JFK and Marilyn to Krim's apartment home and on to the Carlyle Hotel, where JFK maintained a penthouse. Kilgallen's rival columnist Earl Wilson said, "It was the last prolonged encounter between them." Meanwhile, Marilyn, along with her prized dog Maff, given to her by Frank Sinatra, had moved into her new home in Brentwood, California, near Santa Monica. It had been purchased for $77,500, $665,000 in modern currency. Marilyn paid for it partly in cash while assuming a mortgage for half the value. When she signed the documents, a smile as big as Texas was plastered on her face. Despite the happy birthday celebration and the brief sexual encounter, the relationship between JFK and Marilyn had cooled, with many believing JFK had dumped her based on orders from Joe Kennedy, who was afraid the affair would become public, taint the president's reputation, and harm his political ambitions. What is true for certain is that JFK and Marilyn talked many times during the next months, and Marilyn, like Kilgallen, must have been aware that the only reason JFK was in office was because Joe Kennedy had called in his mafia friends to rig the 1960 election. Due to Marilyn's knowledge of this and other facts JFK had shared with her, was she becoming the actress who knew too much, just as Kilgallen would become the reporter who knew too much 3 years later? How hurt Marilyn was that JFK had broken her heart by jilting her is subject to conjecture, but no doubt exists that she had entered the lion's den of the Kennedy family, and then she dipped further into Joe and company because there was another Kennedy standing in the wings who favored the sexy movie star, Robert Francis Kennedy. He was not just Bobby anymore, but the powerful attorney general of whom Papa Joe had said, "Bobby's a great kid. He hates the same way I do." Always aware of public events, Marilyn had to have known that once RFK became attorney general, he had pounced on certain mafioso like a rabid dog, despite his father's promise that if the underworld figures helped JFK win the presidential election, the new administration would leave them alone. But RFK, his ego run amok, had to roar and go after the bad guys, especially Carlos Marcello, whom he deported and then charged with racketeering. Bobby was now the big shot, and, after the happy birthday celebration, Marilyn spoke fondly of RFK, who had done something JFK never considered, talking to her like the intelligent woman that she was about current affairs and politics. Upset with how the production for Something's Got to Give was proceeding, especially the fact that script revisions were ongoing, disappointed that she was being typecast in what she believed was a warmed-over version of a previously outdated movie, and seething about the fact that Elizabeth Taylor was receiving a salary 10 times hers for Taylor's role in Cleopatra, Marilyn called things to a halt. Displaying a caring side to her personality many never considered, she dictated a telegram message to the more than 100 members of the crew, similar to the telegram she sent to director George Cukor. Showing no sympathy, Fox executives, as noted, suspended/fired her. But by mid-July, less than a month before she died, production resumed. Worse, harm to her reputation had been done since Fox let it be known she had mental issues. At this point, she needed a friend, and presto, there was RFK knocking at the door. He listened to her sob story, one that included not only the Fox dismissal, but the fact that RFK's brother would no longer take her calls at the White House. Did Marilyn have mental issues at the time? Was she unstable? Proof this was not the case comes from videotapes of her on screen, including the screen test for Something's Got to Give. Watch closely, and one sees her looking fabulous in a tight black-and-white dress. The Marilyn smile is there as she twirls around the room, balancing herself perfectly on high heels. She is bright and alert, her smile dazzling at every turn. She is Marilyn the Magnificent, the Marilyn the world loved. Another example of Marilyn being on cue is the outtakes from the movie. Again, watch closely her mannerisms, her facial expressions, the Marilyn laugh around a pool. When the dog owner has trouble getting the movie dog to speak, Marilyn doesn't get panicky. She just sits there patiently. When she chats with the kids at the pool, the dialogue is smooth, no slurring of words at all. In a scene with her close friend Dean Martin and Wally Cox talking about an island of some sort, she is charming, quick to answer when Martin asks questions, alert and ready to perform her craft, totally on target. Such proof of Marilyn having all of her faculties during the short time before her death in 1962 is reminiscent, as noted, of the proof offered about Kilgallen's state of mind when she died. Certainly, as noted, on her final What's My Line show, she presents an image of the revered media icon at her very best, with no indication of any drug or alcohol problems within hours of her death.